Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, Baseball Prospectus' local site, covering the Chicago White Sox. You can follow this podcast on iTunes by searching for the Catbird Speaks. You can also find us on our Blog Talk Radio page or your favorite podcast app. I am Colin Whitchurch, joining you from Austin, Texas, and joining me today, as always, from New York City is Nick Schaefer. Hey, Nick.
Hello, Colin. Good talking to you.
Yeah, and we have a special guest today joining us from Houston, writer for TheRinger.com is where you can find his work. You can also listen to the MLB podcast on The Ringer. It is Michael Bauman. Hi, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You get two people from Texas and one from New York City. And
I was thinking about
White
that.
Sox Baseball.
Great, very Chicago-centric podcast.
Yeah, we surprisingly don't have very many if any anymore, now that Cat's gone, I guess, Chicago-based White Sox writers on our site.
Oops.
So the White Sox are, as we talk here Sunday afternoon, they're 13-9. Michael wrote an article before spring training saying that the White Sox were a good value bet for the World Series at 100-1, something like that. So, Michael, are you counting your winnings yet?
This is not how I thought they'd get there. If I recall correctly, the White Sox World Series route involved big seasons by Tim Anderson and Carlos Rodon and Jose Quintana, who now has a 5-and-change ERA. So, yeah, but, you know, I'm willing to take credit for the White Sox being in first place, even if this team bears absolutely no resemblance to how I thought they'd get there.
It's been a really interesting route. I mean, Abreu finally started hitting as well, but even before that, it was like all of their, you know, Frazier, Anderson, Abreu, all these veteran guys that you pointed out in your article are not typically what you'd expect on a team that's being projected to be a, you know, a, I guess tanking or whatever you want to call it, rebuilding.
But yeah, that surprised me. The big White Sox offseason stories were obviously the trades of Eaton and Sale, and the ongoing narrative is when will they trade Quintana and to whom, because they're going in the tank. And that never made any sense to me. I mean, this is what the article was about, essentially. Like, the talent that they got was just so close to the majors that now I was looking at this team like, they suck the past couple years, and they're not going to get that much worse this year, and they're going to be way better going forward, like to the point where Quintana could be the part of the next good White Sox team. So it's just been frustrating because fans of good teams and writers who cover good teams, and we get a lot of this down in Houston just because Quintana to the Astros is an ongoing rumor. They think that, like, Teams with good players owe it to baseball to, like, to allocate the talent more efficiently. Like, I just really wish I could shake these people and say, like, the game does not owe you a Pareto efficient distribution of talent. Like, the White Sox don't need to trade Jose Quintana for nothing just because it would be convenient for other people. So I like that they've held on to him, if not, you know, the results so far.
Yeah, I mean, because I started having the argument with people with Quintana where people were saying, oh, they just should have traded him for whatever they could get. And I'm sitting here thinking, he's under contract for 4 years. He's not that expensive. He's really good. And if you're scared that he'll pitch worse or get hurt and it'll diminish his trade value, if you just pull the trigger at the first garbage return you can get, guess what? You've just fast forwarded to what you're afraid of, you know, which is getting a bad return for Quintana. And once I started having that argument with some people on Twitter, some Phillies Twitter people came to my defense because they've already fought this war with Cole Hamels. And so I don't know if that's something that, Michael, if you can connect to.
Well, that was pretty much the last thing I wrote when I was writing for Crash Burn Alley. The Phillies site was like 2,500 words. It was like six reasons why Ruben Amaro has been right to hold on to Cole Hamels. And this just got worse. I mean, there was a lot of Red Sox people with that attitude of like, this bad team owes us its good player. And like the example I used was Mookie Betts, who turned out to be way better than anybody thought he would be as a prospect. So, like, the article itself hasn't aged that well. But, you know, with a relatively young pitcher who could be on the next good, you know, Phillies back then, White Sox now team, Like, you can hang on to that guy. And maybe you get burned, but maybe you do what the Phillies did. And like when they traded to the Rangers, they didn't get Mazzara. They didn't get Gallo. They didn't get Profar. But they got Jared Eichhoff, who's turned out to be really good. They got Jorge Alfaro, who is – I mean, he looks like the catcher of the future right now. And those were the third and fourth best prospects at the time of the trade. So maybe something creative. Like they didn't trade him for like – you know, they didn't trade a dollar for – 2 50-cent pieces. They traded a dollar for like three quarters, two dimes, and a nickel, and wound up getting, you know, they wound up getting creative, but they wound up getting pretty good value for him just by hanging on. And, you know, I think Rick Hahn showed that he's got the savvy to pull off trades like that, getting really good returns for Sale and Eaton. So, you know, I think if somebody blows him away, like the fake trade I've been making is Quintana for Bregman straight up, because I know the, like, the hang-up is the Astros don't want to give up, I think it's Feliz and Paulino together. And I think that giving up Bregman would hurt them less than giving up Feliz and Paulino together, just because so much of Bregman's value is predicated on playing shortstop. So that's something I've kicked around. You know, but if the White Sox get an offer like that, they should obviously pull the trigger, but they shouldn't just jump at anything just to say they've – you know, just to make it look like they're doing something, particularly now that they're in first place.
One of the more
Colin.
No, I was just going to say one of the more interesting things, at least from the fans' point of view in these trade discussions, too, with Quintana, is how perpetually underrated he's been over the past couple of years. You know, as you know, he's been one of the top pitchers in the American League for the past 4 years, whereas a guy like Hamels, you know, performed on the national stage, you know, pitched well in a World Series. Right. Whereas with Quintana, at least from the fans' perspective, they don't know who the hell that guy is unless they watch a lot of White Sox games.
Go ahead, Nick.
Oh yeah, I was just, Hamels too had the issue of even though the contract at the time it was market value, or even a little under market value, because he was making roughly what $20 million a year, something like that.
24-6 for $144 was the deal. I forget how far into it he was when the trade happened.
So you could legitimately say, listen, you know, we'd love to trade for Hamels, but like, you know, that is a big salary to take on, whereas Quintana's owed, you know, less than $10 million a year for the next few years. You can't even really – every team can take that on. I mean, that's what Derek Holland's making this year.
Right. And I think, like, a lot of I think that money, you know, particularly for really good players, is sort of an overrated consideration, just because, you know, I wrote about this on the offseason too. Like, Mike Trout and Clayton Kershaw are making – or they're going to make like $33, $34 million a year going forward. But when you take into account not only their actual on-field value, but the scarcity of being able to concentrate that much value in one position, if you put them out on the open market, like, honestly, those guys might be worth $70 or $80 million a year. So, and we watch a lower and lower percentage of overall league revenue going to the players. As you know, as revenue overall goes up, it becomes a $10 billion a year sport where players are getting like 38% of the revenue as opposed to 50 or more a decade ago. Like, teams can afford to pay guys like Quintana not just $20 million a year, but like, you know, 30, 35. But I think Quintana, in addition to pitching for bad teams, there is something always scary. Like, he was about as good as Sale was last year, but you want the guy with the stuff if performance is equal, because just you're going to be afraid that whatever Quintana is doing just isn't going to work anymore. Whereas, you know, Sale, you see the velocity, you see the slider. You know, Quintana, you sort of, it's like not as readily you know, apparent that this guy is that good. So I think, you know, even for teams to really drill into the numbers and scout well, and obviously, you know, the White Sox, you know, not even the White Sox, but like the 29 other big league teams have a better idea of the kind of pitcher Quintana is than you or I do, just because they've got so much more data. But even then, I can imagine it being a little scary to give up like a top 10 overall prospect for a guy like that.
Yeah, and fans, I guess I don't know if it's a matter of selling it to your fan base as well, because, you know, the average fan is going to look and be like, Quintana, he just won, you know, 10 games for the first time last year. And, you know, and at the same time, people are, I think, more aware of prospects in a general sense. Like, they're excited about the big names in their system, but they still don't quite understand, the risk. Like, there's still at that
all these space guys are going to fail. Exactly.
Yeah, they're still at that space where, you know, if you're a Yankee fan, I saw somebody saying, you know, oh, well, I wouldn't trade Blake Rutherford for Quintana straight up because Rutherford's going to be like an MVP or whatever. And, it's, you know, maybe he's going to be a huge corner bat, but he might also, like, you know, hit double A and all of a sudden he can't hack it. And, you know, have fun with Michael Pineda while you try to, like, push for the playoffs instead of Jose Quintana. It's like not it's not as right. not as clear cut.
Everybody thinks their own guys are going to be, you know, they just see the ceiling and are like, okay, this is the ceiling now. Like, you know, I've got to, you know, an Astros guy who was saying that he wouldn't trade for Quintana right now because Joe Musgrove is as good as Quintana is right at this moment. And I'm like, well, I like Joe Musgrove, but like, that's not even close to being true. So,
right. And, you know, you get situations too, where, you know, you look at Jorge Alfaro, especially, you know, I guess just cause we were just talking about him and, you know, the huge arm and the huge power and you're like, oh man, he's going to be the next Johnny Bench, but you know, maybe he's just the next, like, I don't know, downside of Brian McCann's career. Like, he could be that,
especially with catchers.
Oh, no, I was going to say, you know, the worst case scenario is he's like, I don't know, who's a, like a really athletic corner outfielder who can't make contact at all. Like bad years of Mark Whitten. I think, you know, you could go even farther down.
For sure. I mean, I guess as you've become, you know, more of a national writer than a Phillies centric writer, I know that can affect your perspective a little bit, but you know, we're, even though the White Sox have basically been rebuilding results wise for a while, this is the first year that they've gone into the season just sort of conceding the results. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of White Sox fans are kind of adjusting. Do you have any wisdom from your years as a Philly rebuild follower to share with the White Sox fan base?
Yeah, you don't have to watch every single game. Like, it's okay to check out. You know, I think, you know, I went from when I first started writing about baseball when I was coming out of college, like I lived and died with the Phillies. And, you know, that was when they were, you know, winning the division every single year for 5 years in a row. And I was, you know, going to 20 games a year and watching on TV, probably like 130, 140 games a year. And, you know, I moved out of the area and I started writing nationally. And so like I had better, you know, I had other things to do, you know, to the point where last year, I don't know if I watched as many as half a dozen Phillies games start to finish, but I don't know, like this is supposed to be fun. And, you know, I'm also a Philadelphia 76ers fan and I've gotten really into the Sixers, the worse they've gotten, because it's sort of a fun thing. You know, it's a fun community growing up around that story. But like, this is a leisure activity, you know, being a sports fan, this isn't like a matter of honor or anything. Like if you're not having fun doing it, and if the emotional input is like just making you angry and frustrated, like it's okay to, you know, just not pay attention for a little while and come back when you've cooled down a little bit. You know, I think, you know, I've gotten away from, I used to be like one of those people who said, you know, who called out bandwagoners. And I think like the problem people have is not with bandwagoners. It's with people who sort of misrepresent themselves. And like, you know, if you say, you know, I just couldn't take it for a little while, but you know, I'm hopping back on, then, you know, people respect that, particularly if, you know, if you got the history. So, but you know, I just, one thing that like being divorced from like that big emotional investment has taught me is how much that informs like everything that we do when we're talking about sports. Like I think it's Craig Calcaterra's pinned tweet is like, life makes a lot more sense when you accept that like 80% of what people say and do is just base tribalism. And like, you know, you got to be able to separate yourself from the team. Like, even if that is a big part of your identity, whether, you know, I'm a White Sox fan and that's a huge part of who I am. Like, you've got to understand that you're not the White Sox and you can, you know, take a little bit of distance when you need to and take the long view. And like, you don't, when your team loses, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. And, you know, on the flip side, it, you know, when your team wins, it doesn't mean you're a good person either. I just think everybody just needs to be, he needs to care about 15% less when it comes to sports.
Yeah. I went to White Sox Yankees I took my parents the other week, and it was the first game of the series where they just got blown out. And you know, they fell behind early. I was looking at the lineup, you know, Jacob May was up there with his zero batting average. And I was just like, okay, you know, they're going to lose this game. And that's fine. And as opposed to, you know, the other night they blew out the Royals 3 games in a row. And I made a point to watch every pitch because I was like, well, if they're going to play well, I'll savor that. Mm-hmm. Cause I don't know when that's going to happen again. And that's good too. although, speaking of sort of intense emotional, even though most White Sox fans have accepted that this year is probably not going to continue with this winning record, White Sox Twitter seems to hate Cody Achey a lot.
Oh yeah,
and I know he's got history with the Phillies as well.
Another person with whom I have extensive experience. Yeah, so he came up through the Philly system, and this was at a point in time where like. It was bad timing for him because he came up just when like everybody realized that slide was completely irreversible. And he came up with sort of unfair expectations because everybody said, oh, a late bloomer who's a college bat and left-handed hitting 6'1", you know, sort of scrappy white second baseman with a little bit of power, or I guess he was over to third base by that point. Everybody said, oh, he's the next Chase Utley. And I'm like,
oh God,
this guy's going to die. Like, and sure enough, that's what happened. He was not good enough defensively to hold down third base. And then Michael Franco came up and was, you know, the jury's still out on him too, for a certain extent, but it became very clear that Ashy was not the third baseman of the future. And he bounced around to left field and just never really learned how to hit. And, I guess, good for him that he's pulling down a major league paycheck, but I also like, he's also one of those guys who went through the floor of like, you know, he shouldn't be in the lineup every day to like, I feel a little bad watching him play. And
yeah, it's weird watching, you know, you're watching and I see the ire directed towards him and I'm like, this guy's career is kind of dying before our eyes, so maybe we should.
Yeah, he's doing the best he can. Like, yeah. You know, I'm sure he doesn't like, this isn't fun for him either.
No.
it also doesn't help that he's splitting time with a young, a slightly more intriguing player who is mashing the hell out of the ball when he's not striking out in Matt Davidson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the White Sox to a certain extent. Like, he's not writing his own name in the lineup.
For sure.
Yeah. And then I guess you kind of get to that perverse incentive of like, well, is Ashy a name who's credible, at least as a, you know, he's been a major leaguer, you know, is that where you're trying to improve your draft position? Like, is that even a consideration, or is it, you know, you're trying to protect Davidson from tougher righties? Like, there's a lot of weird variables at play, and you start, I don't know, you can lose yourself in conspiracy theories with that.
Yeah. I think there's something to protecting Davidson from, you know, from tough righties, but you know, eventually he's going to have to sink or swim, but maybe you want to bring him along a little bit slowly. But I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm a huge fan of the hard tank in basketball and hockey, and to a certain extent football, where draft position matters so much. But like, you can, and you know, pretty much anywhere in the top half of the draft, in most cases, you're going to have a decent chance at getting a star level player. But it's all on scouting and player development. Like, you know, there's no the drafts where it's, you know, Steven Strasburg 1 and Dustin Ackley 2. And, you know, by the way, Dustin Ackley was supposed to be a future. Like, there was a credible argument to be made for taking him ahead of Strasburg in that draft. That's how good he was at North Carolina. But drafts like that are just so rare. So, you know, the difference between, you know, I think you should root for your team to go 72 and 90 rather than 62 and 100, just because draft position doesn't matter that much.
And so much more tolerable is just
right. Oh, there's so, like, the difference between a 70-win team and a 60-win team, just from an aesthetic perspective and a feeling like the world is out to get you perspective, is enormous. Like, I would just I'd rather take the hit on half a dozen draft positions and just be a little bit happier in the short term than do the opposite.
Yeah. And
on the topic of drafts, I guess, just to switch gears a little bit, obviously you have quite a bit of a background in following college baseball, and we're about a month and a half from this draft. Is there, you know, the White Sox pick 11th. Doing mock drafts or making draft predictions in baseball is even, even more foolish than in, mm-hmm. in basketball and football. But are there any guys, you know, that are going to go toward that top half of the draft that we as fans should be keeping an eye on?
One guy, this guy was actually my my number one prospect on my own board coming into the season was Florida right-hander Alex Fajardo, who's struggled a little bit, and he might slide all the way back to 11. I think probably the best college prospect right now is Jaron Kendall, who's a five-tool outfielder from Vanderbilt. He's started there since he was a freshman. He is an absolute stud. I think he, you know, and this is a program that's produced David Price and Dansby Swanson. He might be the best Vandy position. I think he might be a better position player prospect than Swanson was. But, you know, if Fajardo slides, he might be the guy that you could get some value out of. And particularly if the White Sox have been so pitching heavy in their minor league system, and you know they're getting value out of guys like Alec Hansen, for instance, who was just a complete write-off at this point last year. I think there might be value in one of those college pitchers who falls. So Fajardo would be a guy to keep an eye on, and he'll be on TV constantly with Florida, particularly through the NCAA tournament.
Is Jaron Kendall? Is he related to Jason at all, or is
that no?
Oh, okay, I got excited. Yeah, and I noticed, you know, 11. And maybe it's just a couple names that have maybe I'm disproportionately weighing based on some sort of confirmation bias. But, you know, Conforto was there at 10. And I feel like some of the, like, polished college bats that don't have a ton of positional value can be had around there where the White Sox are picking, which might be worth keeping an eye on. And as soon as you mentioned Strasburg, Ackley, I went to the 2010 draft where it went Harper, Tyon, Machado, and then Christian Colon at 4, which is like so. That's like one of the rare scenarios where like winning 68 or 70 games is like may have really crushed you. But there were Harvey and Sale were available there too. If they play their cards right,
right. And Harvey and Sale are guys like those guys were supposed to be relievers coming out of college. They're really good college starters and. Just Sale with the delivery, Harvey with the, I think had some durability concerns, and you know the velocity wasn't where it is now. There's a guy, I don't know if I've got one this year just because I haven't followed college baseball as closely as I usually do. There's usually at least one guy in the first like half of the first round who's like usually a Midwestern college performer who. Who I get high on and start pumping up. And, you know, Kyle Schwarber was that for me when he was a sophomore at Indiana. Ian Happ, who's now in the Cubs system. I saw him his junior year at Cincinnati, and he was just had an unbelievable feel for hitting. Last year, it was Brian Reynolds, who's in another Vandy outfielder who's in the Giants system now. There's a kid out of Missouri State named Jake Berger, who's huge power hitting third baseman who probably has to move to first, but he hit like 20 home runs last year. He's probably going to do it again in like a 60 game season. He's just got a really good feel to hit, really good power. It's not a great body, but you know, he's a guy who could be around in the teens, or I mean, he'll definitely be around in the teens, I imagine, but you know, he's sort of that. He's not as good an athlete as Conforto, but if you're looking for a polished college bat in a draft that doesn't really have a ton of them, he's probably your guy this year.
It's a great name for making puns, too.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say the nominative determinism on that is superb.
I was just having this conversation with somebody like, you know, he's a little doughy and his name is Berger. And that's,
Are there one profile that I do like, though, and maybe it's just because Sale and Aaron Nola is a guy like this where they had a little bit of a funky delivery, but in college they came into the draft with like very good fastball command and like a good changeup, but not much of a breaking ball. And then as soon as you get them in pro ball, you teach them like a grip based pitch or a breaking pitch, and all of a sudden their profile looks a whole lot better. I don't know. Is there anybody in that phylum that's going to be in the draft coming out of college this year at all?
Brendan McKay is, you know, he's got good fastball command. He doesn't have, I mean, the velo ticked up for Sale and Nola too. I mean, McKay has usually been low 90s, but he's got really good command, good breaking ball. Not on Nola's level, obviously, because I don't remember, maybe Rodon that same year. Like that was probably the only college breaking ball that was good, as good as Nola's. But McKay's probably going to go top two. He's he's hitting like 400, 500, 600 as a first baseman, and also has like a 120 ERA as the number one starter for Louisville right now. So I don't think he's going to be on the board. Fiedo is, he had good command when I saw him last year. He struggled with it a little bit this year, but he's a big physical guy, just sort of like, I feel like if he doesn't get hurt, he's, and there's no like real reason to think he's going to get hurt, but like, he just seems like a real nailed on like number three starter type. I don't know who the sleeper is right now. There are a couple guys who are coming out of college now who were big prospects as high schoolers and didn't sign, but a lot of those guys like Bryce Montes de Oca out of Missouri have fallen, and it's just because of the performance hasn't really been there.
There is a guy I wanted to ask you about just because he was pitching in college last year, who's kind of caught the eye of a lot of Sox fans this year since coming over in the Eaton trade. It's Dane Dunning. I know he pitched in relief for Florida last mm-hmm. year because the rotation was so stacked, and the Sox started him in Kannapolis this year, and he tore it up so well that he's already headed to Winston-Salem. What did you see out of him, I guess, during the draft process and like his future prospects?
Yeah, I actually saw him live last year when I was in Gainesville, and Florida's rotation last year was Friday night starters Logan Shore, who was SEC pitcher of the year and a sandwich round pick to the A's. Number two was Fiedo. Number three was AJ Puck, who went number six overall to the A's. So like, that's a kind of, and they had a couple other guys who were top 100 picks out of high school who were pitching out of the bullpen as freshmen. They had Kirby Snead, a killer lefty out of the pen. They had Sean Anderson as their closer. So Dunning was like performing like sort of a long relief, like sort of Chris Devensky style role. And he came in and threw a few innings. And I mean, that's major league starter stuff. It was low 90s fastball, good command, good secondary stuff. He's, maybe you want him to fill out a little bit more, but he probably will as he, stops sweating off 20 pounds a game pitching in Gainesville. But I mean, like he would have started for probably literally any other program in the country. I mean, Florida's got such a stacked rotation because they've got a reputation of taking care of pitchers. So you see guys who, who top prospects who don't sign in the draft, guys like Brady Singer, who's a sophomore right now there, who like they do a really good job of keeping those guys healthy. So it's like a safe place to go if you don't sign and you want to develop. And also their head coach, Kevin O'Sullivan, is a really good pitching coach. He coached Puck from, I think, like a 37th rounder to top five over the course, or top six over the course of 3 years. So for that reason, Florida pitchers tend not to, they tend not to put up big college numbers just because they don't get leaned on as much. So Dunning was a sleeper, but I think everybody saw that and saw, either really good relief pitcher, or maybe, number three, number four starter if everything works out well. So, I mean, that was a really savvy get at the end of the Eaton trade.
You mentioned Alec Hansen earlier, and how he was kind of an afterthought, a guy who was kind of a top draft prospect who had a terrible year at Oklahoma last year. I just saw a tweet come across my line that he took a no-hitter into the sixth inning this afternoon. What was his problem last year? What needed fixing once he got to the major league level?
Well, so Hansen went into – well, first, the first thing you need to know about Alec Hansen, he's a huge guy. Like, was he listed at – is he listed at 6'7"? Like, he's
just either 6'6" or 6'7", yeah.
Yeah. So his end of his sophomore year at Oklahoma, he and Puck were 1-2 for, as far as college starting pitchers who could go number one overall. And then Hansen came into his junior year at Oklahoma and just lost it. Like, he could not throw strikes even in the slightest. So like, the stuff wasn't all that good. The stuff, like, he was still throwing hard, still, mid to upper 90s fastball, still good breaking stuff, but he just couldn't throw strikes. So, and this, the effect of this was that he went from Friday night starter to number one overalls, or the number one starter for Oklahoma, to falling completely out of the rotation for an Oklahoma team that wasn't that good. Like, they just couldn't use him. So the talent was still there, and the question was, could you get the command back? And I think the White Sox, that's the kind of guy I like taking chances on, like, because I feel like if it was in their – like 6 months ago. It's still in there now. And they've done a really good job of harnessing him. Like, he could have been – I mean, like, he's the kind of guy who could have been out of baseball within 18 months of the draft if they hadn't straightened that out. But, you know, he could be a closer or, you know, mid-rotation starter if they do. So that's a really good use of a draft pick for, you know, from my perspective. The other thing you need to know about Hanson, he has, like, the best pitch face. I've got – and, like, no two are really the same. So, like, I've got saved on – on my computer, like a photo gallery of like 8 Alec Hanson pitch faces, you know, to suit different moods. So do yourself a favor and do a Google image search of Alec Hanson.
I will.
That's fantastic. And I guess that's kind of illustrative too. I mean, we're talking now, I guess it's only 6 weeks or so out from the draft right now, as opposed to 6 months, but you know, between how much things can change. And I think actually you're right. I mean, speaking of Hanson, that's somebody that something that can get overrated is like the immediately recent performance, especially if there isn't like some sort of injury concern. And
or even, you know, if there is, like, you know,
yeah,
Giolito could have gone 1-1, but he missed his senior year of high school because he got Tommy John. So,
and you get, you know, high school guys like pop up out of nowhere because the difference between, I don't know, I guess the difference of a few months for when you're talking about like 17-year-old huge athletes is can be pretty mm-hmm. huge also. But I'm sad that Alex Call is on the DL, because I think I remember he was a sort of favorite of yours once upon a time.
Yeah, he was. So for the 2015 season, I was the Midwest regional writer for D1 baseball, and that's an area that doesn't get covered a whole lot. Like, most college baseball writers are either here in Texas or in the Carolinas or Florida or California. So I wound up seeing a lot of not only Big Ten, but Missouri Valley Horizon League. And that's where I first saw Berger when he was a freshman at Missouri State. But Alex Call, like, killed it, just absolutely crushed it for Ball State for a couple years. And, you know, he was – I mean, it's tough to draw conclusions from, you know, from Ball State, particularly for a position player. But, you know, I'm glad to see that he landed somewhere.
Here's a question pivoting back to learning from your experience with Hamels now in Texas. You know, we're watching Chris Sale pitching in a non-White Sox jersey for the first time. How did you navigate that sort of emotional experience? Is that just part of the detaching a little bit, or is it just, hey, you know, you're a Cole Hamels fan and you wish him the best? Or
yeah, something? I think the healthy thing to do, and this is not to say that it's something that I myself have always done across the board, but the healthy thing to do is, if you like the player when he was part of your favorite team and the break wasn't like absolutely acrimonious, I'm trying to think of something that, you know, where a guy like absolutely torched the city on his way out of town, leaving as a free agent or whatever. Like, you know, I like to support athletes rather than or in addition to supporting teams. So, you know, I think this is what most Phillies fans have done. They've said, you know, Hamels was in his prime and the Phillies weren't going anywhere and they traded him. Like, he, you know, he was a good soldier about it. And, you know, I think everybody wished him the best on the way out the door. And I imagine that's how, you know, how White Sox fans probably feel about Sale, right? I mean,
Sale, I guess, because, I mean, Hamels did get the championship with you guys at one point, and, you know, Sale didn't quite get there through no fault of his own. And I think there's some contingent of the fan base that, like, really didn't like him cutting up the throwback jerseys. Like, that really upset some
That's
people.
That's understandable. Like, I understand being put off by that. But hilarious as I found that episode from a distance, but...
I think a lot of it also has to do with the team they go to. Like, if you're not a Red Sox fan, you probably loathe the Red Sox. And it's really like, I want Sale, I'm from a personal standpoint, I want Sale to succeed, but it's really hard for me to root for the Red Sox to succeed. And so that probably plays a role into it as well.
And I think that helped because the other teams that Hamels was rumored to possibly be going to were the Red Sox, who everybody hates, and the Dodgers, with whom the Phillies have a lot of recent history. So I think going to Texas, where, I don't know, like the Cowboys-Eagles thing isn't – like, it doesn't transcend sports to the point where Phillies fans hate the Rangers. So, you know, it's – I think that helped the transition a little bit. But, you know, I think it was also a long time coming. And I think having, if it doesn't fall apart over the course of a couple weeks, then and you have some time to prepare emotionally, then when it happens, I think it's almost like as much a relief as anything else.
I'm so through the looking glass though. Like I'm on here's where I'm at with Sale in terms of, you know, just the basic of I've always been a Chris Sale fan. I hope he does well. Also, there were some articles that I saw around the time that, you know, they weren't all they weren't, you know, of varying quality. Some of them were, you know, worth considering, from Red Sox people saying this was a mistake, we gave up too much. And so now I've got this sort of reflexive, like, I want him to do really, really well to spite the people that it's benefiting almost.
Just yeah. Prospect hunters are really annoying.
They are. Yeah.
And I say this, like, they might have actually given up too much, but like, they're not going to use Mankata. They're not going to use Kopech. They could win a World Series now. And, you know, that's, I mean, it's a trade I do. They certainly gave up a ton to get him, but also Chris Sale's really good. So like, yeah, I mean, you don't give up Yoan Moncada, you don't get Chris Sale. Like, that's how trades work. But yeah, prospect huggers are really annoying, and no prospect huggers are more annoying than Red Sox prospect huggers, which is why I found Dave Dombrowski's tenure, as somebody who has no regard for minor leaguers as anything but currency to get good, you know, to get good players now. You know, I've found his tenure so gratifying. But, you know, but that leaves alone, like, the Red Sox have Bogarts, Benintendi, Bradley, Betts. Like, that's four, you know, Bradley's over 25 now, but that's, you know, four all-stars who are locked up for, you know, for the next 3 years at least. You know, Benintendi and Betts could easily win MVPs in that time. So it's not like they're, you know, mortgaging a future that, I don't know. Like, yeah, you trade Moncada to get Chris Sale because he's Chris Sale.
Yeah, and some of the arguments too, one of the arguments was, well, the Red Sox have plenty of pitching, they didn't need to do this. And then flash forward like 3 months later and Price is like, you know, hovering around getting Tommy John, Porcello's, hey, surprise, his ERA is over four again. Like, he's done that before. you know, and you've got Steven Wright's ERA above eight sitting at your, you know, third slot in the rotation. So like, this did definitely happen. I mean, like, yeah. I guess anytime you say, well, we've got plenty of pitching, you're just like tempted.
Man, exactly. I mean, that happened to the Dodgers last year. They figured, you know, and like the Astros are doing it to a certain extent this year. Like, you figure you get eight good starting pitchers and five of them have to be healthy at some point, and that's not strictly speaking true. So, and you know, we just recorded tomorrow's episode of the Ringer MLB show this morning. Ben and I did, and we talked about how this is happening to the Mets. And since then and now, Noah Syndergaard's walked off the mound holding his shoulder. So we're going to have to go back and record that. So
yeah,
that's annoying just because it's inconvenient to me personally, but you know, yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Like, you can never have too many good starting pitchers because I understand not trading for another right fielder because you got Betts, but like, you get five starting pitchers and you're going to use more. So like, you don't not trade for Sale because you got Price.
And I think it's interesting too, because like, you had Cleveland just last year had three frontline guys. And then by the end of the season, they lost two of them to sort of fluke occurrences in Salazar and Carrasco. And then, you know, they made it as close as you can get without winning the World Series. But that was based on, you know, Kluber pitching to the absolute best of his ability and as much as he possibly could. Bring the bullpen in as early as you could, and then just praying that, you know, Tomlin and Bauer could get you through when you needed it. And, you know, so you go from a team that's predicated on a deep front of the rotation to just absolutely not that overnight, basically. So, yeah, never know what's going to happen there. And I did actually, before I came on here, you were talking about the Mets injuries. I just got off the phone with my buddy who's a huge Nationals fan, and he was, you know, Eaton just destroyed his leg, and he was saying, you know, what does the team do? And the bullpen's so bad. And he was saying, maybe we should just wait and try to consolidate for 2018. I don't know what, like, if you were in charge of the Nationals right now, like, how would you respond? Cause they are in first place, but
yeah, like, they're in first place. They got Bryce Harper and Max Scherzer. like, I don't know. They won the division without Eaton. Like, they didn't use any of the guys that they gave up to get him. Like, this is a better team than it was last year with a full season of Trey Turner. I think, you know, just because their other center field options are so bad, I think maybe you think about getting a stopgap. I don't know who I don't know. Maybe you try to coax Angel Pagan at a at a sitting out the season or something like that. But like, you know, I don't think this changes anything as far as Washington's perspective. Like, you're going to give up when you're this far ahead with the Mets are absolutely in the toilet. Like,
I guess maybe not give up, but maybe consider not buying, I guess, just sort of standing pat and hope, you know, hey, give it the best run you can with what you have on hand, as opposed to trying to supplement and turn it into a super team, I guess, would be the choice.
Yeah, I think that supplement and turn it into a super team is kind of what they tried to do by trading for Eaton in the first place. You know, I wouldn't trade Victor Robles for, I don't even know who the center fielder you'd go get is, but you know, I think you'd probably want to make some sort of incremental improvement. Like if Michael Taylor doesn't get you all the way back to replacement level and centered, like maybe you go get somebody who gets you back to replacement level. But if, you know, I think this team's good enough to win the division as is. And then ideally you go into the postseason with, you know, Scherzer, Strasburg and Gio Gonzalez and Tanner Roark and, you know, Joe Ross, if he's healthy, you know, I guess that'll be the first time, but it, you know, take your chances. I like that team as much as any other coming out of the National League, even with Eaton on the shelf.
I saw a suggestion that the Royals package Lorenzo Cain and Kelvin Herrera to Washington. That was probably the biggest name I saw that they could acquire in some sort of deal. I don't know if that would take someone like Robles, but I know he's really, really good.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing with Washington is Scherzer's only getting older and Harper's gone in, like, what, 2 years? So
this year, next year, yeah, I think.
Like, you can't afford to not capitalize on this.
Yeah, if you're going to go for it, you need to all the way go for it. Something that I think people who follow the White Sox have been frustrated with for a long time.
Yeah, that's what's weird is, like, Michael, your observations about the fact that, you know, the White Sox might wind up holding Quintana all year, and they do have Abreu and Frazier and these types of players that you don't typically find on a traditional rebuilding team. And obviously the bullpen's been like otherworldly. But another aspect of what was so frustrating about the White Sox, quote unquote, contending teams was the back end of their rosters were always so bad. You know, the same people who are furious that Cody Ashe's present on this team, I didn't see them, you know, rending their garments over the fact that Jerry Sands was like the regular DH for a while last year when they were trying to win. But now the fact that, you know, Lurie Garcia is doing pretty well in center field and Omar Narvaez is like getting on base and fielding pretty well at catcher, all of a sudden, just by virtue of patching up those like horrible holes, they winded up kind of making significant improvements like accidentally. And so that can really make a big difference moving forward. I was done if you had something.
Okay. Yeah. That was something that, you know, I was sort of high on the Angels coming into the season, you know, certainly pre Garrett Richards injury, because I mean, they traded, you know, they traded, sorry, I just completely blanked on everything they did. Okay. They had Mike Trout and Cole Calhoun and Richards and a bunch of crap essentially. And they, you know, they improved an F to a C at like five or six different positions by getting, you know, like you said, Maben and Luis Valbuena and guys like that. And I think the White Sox have done a little bit of that too. And they've still got a couple, you know, they'll be better when Cody Ashe isn't their everyday DH. yeah, I wonder, you know, they're technically a big market team, but, you know, sharing that market with the Cubs, particularly the Cubs dominating that market in terms of coverage, you guys would know better than I would probably what their ultimate ceiling in terms of payroll would be. But, you know, I wonder if there's a limit to how many holes they can fill.
It's weird because Reinsdorf is an owner who is willing to – he has these sort of principled stands that he'll take that don't really have anything to do with necessarily profitability. Like, for example, he was he really didn't like spending on amateur talent, so they'd spend the least on the draft for years and years and years, not because they couldn't afford it. They would be signing free agents, and they would periodically bump their payroll up into the top third of the league at the same time as they were, you know, refusing to spend a couple extra million dollars on a draft that may have really moved the needle. So even if even if they are in a contention cycle and they can't afford to bump their payroll up, you know, $20-30 million, he's the type of guy who might feel that, you know, no major league team should spend more than $130 million on players regardless of revenue. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if that was where his head was at. That would certainly explain some of the weird, you know, in heading into, say, 2016, where they refused to spend on, say, a Dexter Fowler when they really could have used him. So that's going to be interesting to watch as they come back up on the upswing, because they did have a really cost-effective cheap core and they still couldn't supplement it correctly. And maybe that's what they're talking about when they talk about having a more sustainable model where it's not stars and scrubs. But, you know, all of this is irrelevant because, as you observed, we're heading into the Colorado Rockies dynasty now, right? Like, that's where we're at now, isn't it?
I mean, if they ever figure out how to, that's a, you know, that's a surprisingly good team. I really have no idea what to make of them, because I wrote about how they were, you know, surprisingly in or around first place, despite having kind of a weird season. And I did that on the back of them having been outscored by like 40 runs over the course of three games by the Nationals. And since then, I think they're undefeated since I wrote that, and they're like 15 or 16 and 9. What are they? Yeah, 16 and 9 with a negative run differential. So I think, you know, part of the run differential is just the nature of the beatdowns they took against Washington. I think part of that is Greg Holland's been really good, and I think Bud Black is, you know, can Buck Showalter them into outperforming their run differential a little bit. But I mean, they're going to slide back. I mean, the Dodgers are going to catch them eventually. So
it's just so strange that as time goes on, as front offices get savvier and savvier, and you know, disaster front offices that, you know, for example, Bill Bevesi was allowed to be in charge of the Mariners for like years and years and years, whereas the Diamondbacks only gave a couple of years to Dave Stewart's disastrous regime. So I feel like there's like a homogeneity that's kind of happening across Major League Baseball front offices as they try to optimize. And it kind of makes things less fun. Like, the existence of the Rockies is a good thing because, you know, in this era where people are clinging to their draft picks and they're really scared to sign mid-level free agents, or they go out and burn the 11 draft pick and like a whole bunch of money on Ian Desmond when their outfield was already loaded. And it's just sort of, nobody can figure it out, and it's kind of great. Like, that's a lot more fun. It's a lot more fun than teams being scared to give Edwin Encarnacion $75 million. Like, at least for me, I take joy in that. So I kind of want them to be rewarded for being zany.
Yeah, and it's particularly because of what Jeff Bridich took over. How, like, it's not only that they were bad under Dan O'Dowd in the later years, it's like the weird kind of creepy ways in which they were bad. You know, I don't know, I like it when the Rockies are good, just because I think Coors Field looks really good on TV, and I like having a reason to watch them. So in addition to, you know, wanting to reward creativity, I guess that, you know, that's a good reason to want them to keep being good.
Nolan Arenado doesn't hurt either.
No, I mean, that's, I just looked up like middle of last season. Like, that's a really good infield, like out of nowhere.
Yeah, LeMahieu's another guy who wound up hitting his, you know, 90 something percentile, and Trevor Story obviously got a lot of ink last year too. So
Desmond came off the DL today too.
There we go.
So I was going to ask, speaking of developments today, I was going to ask if you thought, you know, so Quintana was the high profile trade chip. And then there's the obvious candidates like Frazier and Melky Cabrera, who are going to be free agents and are at the end of the year and are useful players. Not, you know, they're not stars at this point, but they've, so far this year, the White Sox have had kind of surprising developments of, you know, Anthony Swarzak is like unhittable all of a sudden and throws like 97 because that's the majors now. And like Tommy Canley is arguably the best pitcher in the league at the moment. And, you know, you've got guys like Miguel Gonzalez, right? As you know, of course, as we talk about this, he's given up a bunch of runs to the Tigers, but Miguel Gonzalez and Derek Holland have shiny ERAs coming into today. Do you actually, you know, it's hard as a White Sox fan because I'm like hoping that they can get something for those guys. Do you see any of them being desirable or fetching anything on the market?
I mean, it depends. I think you can all, like, there's always a market for a decent reliever. You know, I think if they get down to it and, I'm really not sure if this is a worry or not. Like, if they, you know, fluke into, like, being within a game of first place at the deadline, do they hang on to Frazier and Melky when they could get you something not big but also non-trivial? Yeah, but, you know, assuming they fall back, I think that, you know, that Frazier and Melky will be attractive. You know, and it depends. I mean, I'm not intimately familiar with the contract situations of, you know, Tommy Canely, for instance, but you know, I don't know if that's a guy that you try to hang on to, or, you know, whether you try to capitalize on him having a good season. I mean, it's early. We'll have a better idea of what those guys are worth in 3 months.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, the trade market, I get questions about the trade market as well, so I'm always interested to hear what people think. And, you know, last year you saw global top 20 prospects being traded for relievers, but meanwhile, like, Mark Melanson was traded for, like, nothing. Yeah. So, it that seemed weird to me, so who knows?
Right. Do I think Tommy Canley's going to get, you know, traded for Gleyber Torres? No. you know, like, could he get moved to a contender and, you know, get a nice prospect? You know, I think, like, Nick Pivetta's making his big league debut for the Phillies today, and he was the return in the Jonathan Papelbon deal from Washington. So, like, you know, maybe you get an interesting guy who eventually plays in the majors. My favorite thing about Swarzak playing in Chicago, and I might be the only person who finds this funny because I might be the only person who's seen Backdraft a bunch of times, but the bad guy in Backdraft was a Chicago alderman named Swayzak, and I'm like waiting for the nickname potential for Anthony Swarzak to emerge, and I don't know. It's,
oh my god, I never made that connection.
Yeah, unfortunately, I guess, like, Backdraft implies that he's, like, doing poorly, right? I mean, it'd be like something like a disaster, I would think.
I don't know. But it could mean that he's on fire, and I think it's all in the branding.
I think Colin, I've asked my questions. I don't know if you had anything for Michael before we let him get back to his Sunday.
No, I think we're good. I gotta go let him re-record his Noah Syndergaard comments. Don't want to keep you much longer, Michael, but we really thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
All right, my pleasure.